This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Loving v. Virginia, which overturned state laws banning marriages between people of different races. The case was named for Mildred and Richard Loving, a black woman and a white man who were arrested and then forced to leave their home state of Virginia after they married in violation of state law.
In each episode, we hear from a different couple about what it's like to be in an interracial marriage today. This time, we hear from Leslie and Cord. They met when Cord was a grad student at Duke University in North Carolina, and Leslie was working at the university while applying for graduate school.
Cord had a part-time job working security at the university's art museum, which means he spent a lot of time sitting at the front desk and reading books as he prepared to begin work on his doctoral dissertation. That's what he was doing when he and Leslie first met.
I had to walk by his desk in order to go to the copier, the fax machine, anything like that. So I just started the job. I walked up and was just like, "Hi, I'm Leslie. What are you reading?"
Well, I was reading one of my favorite early medieval authors, St. Augustine. I said, well, I held it up. I said, "I'm reading Augustine's Confessions."
And it just so happens that I had a friend who is a philosopher who focuses on the Catholic Church. I just happened to finish a book that he had recommended that talked about how terrible St. Augustine was for women in the Catholic Church. So I had only met him for 5 minutes. I immediately started talking about how much I hated St. Augustine. And he was very polite about it. And then I had these notes that I had taken. So I came back and I presented him with these notes. And it was only a couple days later that I thought, gosh, why were you so aggressive with that man? He didn't even know you. I was a little embarrassed, but it turns out that Cord was actually kind of...
I was intrigued. I really like St. Augustine, and I said that much to her, but she presented me these notes. And I thought, well, she doesn't seem to work on the same thing I do, but she really knows her St. Augustine, even if she hates him. This is intriguing. I like this.
I think I found out fairly quickly after that he was dating someone. I was kind of dating someone. So it was about a year of just being work friends that he ended up breaking up with somebody. And then ever so slightly in a conversation was just a little bit flirtatious. And it was really at that point that just this light bulb went off where I thought, oh, gosh, we would be such a good match. Then the art museum
moved. And we didn't see each other.
We didn't see each other. So we used that as an excuse. Oh, we should hang out. And then that just turned into dating. My name is Leslie and I'm white.
My name is Cord and I'm black.
And we have a daughter who is 3.
And we've been married since 2009.
So I'm white and I'm also from North Carolina and I grew up right outside of Raleigh, but my parents, and for at least 4 or 5 generations, maybe more back, all grew up in the Appalachian Mountains of North Carolina. So I grew up with relatives who were pretty overtly racist. So a great uncle who refused to speak to another family member who married a black man, that would have been in the 80s. And it really wasn't until I got into college, and then I traveled, I lived in France for a year, and then I got my master's in French Caribbean literature, and then I spent time in the Caribbean, and then I got my PhD focused on Caribbean studies. So it wasn't until I was older that I could understand the more subtle ways that most of my family thought about race or thought about anybody who wasn't white as other. I think maybe the first time I dated somebody who wouldn't have considered themselves white was in my early 20s, but even then it wasn't a thing. It wasn't I'm not dating white people. I'm just trying to think about it, right? So by the time I met Cord, it was like, oh, okay.
It didn't even cross your mind that anyone would have an issue with it in that moment.
Even though I knew that, like, if we were to go to a rural town in North Carolina, that we would probably run into something. I mean, it's not like I'm not aware of it.
Before the first time I went up to the Appalachian Mountains with you, admittedly to see relatives that you knew would be fine with it, but they lived in close proximity to relatives who we knew wouldn't.
Yeah.
You were nervous.
Yeah.
You were nervous. In some ways, maybe you were even more nervous than I was. I was still a little nervous.
Yeah.
But for me, it was also a little bit like, well, You know, I have managed to drive between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh a number of times in my life. And if you can get through central Pennsylvania, then I can handle western North Carolina. My grandfather, my father's father, fled Jim Crow North Carolina and South Carolina. He had grown up in both, but he fled the Jim Crow Carolinas for Philadelphia at the very end of the 40s before meeting my grandmother at a jazz club. So it gets very interesting if you try to talk to him about his experiences with race in his own personal history, because he will tell you stories that make it sound like he was born and raised and always lived in Philadelphia. And you have to very specifically ask about North and South Carolina to get answers.
So what that means is that we don't know that much about his experience. But one thing that he did say told us that he was still informed by that experience, which was...
When I came home after Leslie and I were seriously dating, I was home for a visit, I told him that I was dating this woman, that she was white, and he became very concerned. And he asked what kind of reactions I was getting in North Carolina, right? You know, and I told him that, you know, the circles we rolled in, it was fine. But he did have quite a visceral concern that linked directly back to his own experiences and why he left and only returned once since the 1940s, and that was to bury his mother until our wedding. He did come back for our wedding.
He did come back for our wedding. But yeah, so his reaction was really more about, is my grandson safe? Cord and I got married in January, and there was a big conference that he had to go to at the end of December. So it was right around Christmas. So it was 2 weeks before we got married. Cord left, but I was here in Philadelphia celebrating Christmas with his family. So we were almost married, but not quite. But Grandpa was really insistent that he call me his granddaughter. And he would get very upset if anybody said granddaughter-in-law. But I was still relatively new, so the whole family went to a party, and Grandpa was introducing me to everybody in the family. And it was like, this is my granddaughter. It's my granddaughter. Everybody said, oh, hi, nice to meet you. And then he went to an older gentleman in the family, a kind of a distant cousin, who said, this is my granddaughter. And he just looked at me staring. He goes, who's your mother? And then Cord's mother had to step in and explain. But even in that moment, Grandpa didn't occur to him that anyone would think that that was unusual. So whatever his reservations were really only about what his experience had been.
He adores Leslie. He may like Leslie more than he likes me.
But now that we have a child, she's much more important than either one of us.
She beats everyone.
Cord's a very positive, very optimistic person, and I feel like having relatives, having been in a space where people felt comfortable using the N-word, I feel like having done that, I can sometimes be much more suspicious of people's motivations. And so I think sometimes Cord will be like, oh, and I'm like, I don't know. I think when that person said that thing, they might have been a little bit prejudiced. That's not necessarily that Cord doesn't understand it, but I feel like he doesn't assume it to be present in a way that I do.
I'd say that one of my ways of getting on in the world as a Black man who does particular kind of work where it is not very common to have many other people of color doing it, but also to have been in a lot of other spaces. Like I went to predominantly white schools for college and graduate school. One of my ways, I suppose, of getting along in the world and being an optimist and happy-go-lucky is that until it rises to a certain point, I actually ignore racial prejudice. There are things that I maybe registered them in the back of my mind, but unless something else happens that, you know, makes it rise to a certain level, or unless somebody else mentions it, sometimes that's Leslie, it's been a few other friends in my life too, where I'm like, oh yeah, that thing did happen. That person did say that, or that person did look at me that way. And I noticed, but I didn't notice. Right. But now you're making me notice. Thanks. A I'd say from a very young age, I was always committed to the idea of an interracial world. You know, I can remember very distinctly, I went to a private preschool and it was actually very racially diverse. Our pre-K to kindergarten graduation ceremony was one of these things where you had to, you know, each student had to make out of construction paper the flag of a different country in the world and hold up their flag and sing, you know, it's a small world after all, right? But I bought in. I mean, I've bought in from that very early age to the idea of, you know, a diverse world being an ideal world. But it is interesting because my previous serious relationships, you know, I had dated around with women of multiple races, but my previous serious relationships had all been with women who were either African-American or biracial, African-American and white. So, you know, I suppose once we got a little bit of a ways in, certainly once we got to the point where we were doing things like going to Western North Carolina and realizing she was pretty nervous and realizing I was a little nervous, I thought, okay, this is a little different, right? We are actually coming up against and starting to confront the realities of race in America in our personal relationship in ways that I hadn't necessarily expected to have to, and in ways that I would have thought, sure, if this were the 60s or the 70s or even the 80s, I would have had to. But in 2005 and 6, you know, if I had just been in a conversation with somebody, I would have said, you know, yes, yeah, sure, I'll date somebody who's white and we're not going to have any problem.
I think you've been called the N-word like 3 times in your life. Somebody yelling
it's more
it
like
from,
four.
Four in the street. And 2 of those have been with me. So 1 time was actually in Maine. We were walking down the street and somebody yelled something. I was like, what was that? What did they say? And I couldn't like parse what it was because it was just somebody driving by really quickly.
On
and
this
I said,
idyllic New England bridge on this lovely day while walking by a lobster house.
And I said, what did they say? I said, did they say, I can't remember what I thought the word was. And Cord just looked at me and said, that's not what they said. And then all of a sudden, oh my God, they said that. And I think I was more upset about it than Cord was because it was the first time somebody had shouted that. And the second time it happened, we were in Wales in the UK, and we were walking with another friend of ours who is white, and it was later at night, and there were just some British teenagers who were going by on a bike, and they yelled it.
Yeah. They yelled 2 things. They yelled the N-word at me, and then they yelled a British slang term for, you know, a derogatory term for women at her for being with me, which offended me more, frankly.
So those were 2 kind of overt instances, but they weren't necessarily attacks on us being together, unless maybe they were. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't.
Certainly the one in England actually was.
Yeah.
Having known a number of bi or multiracial friends in my peer group, people my same age, you know, who've had to be very intentional and deliberate about their own identities and who they identify with in which contexts. And I've known people for whom that's been a struggle. I've known people for whom it's been pretty easy. So for me, you know, in our deciding to have children, I knew that it was a possibility that for our child, it might at some point be difficult for her. But we don't have full control over that because it depends on any number of other aspects of her life, such as, you know, who she eventually ends up partnered with. But I think we try to be quite intentional about giving her the tools such that it will hopefully be quite easy for her to make up her own mind about how she identifies. Is she going to want to call herself black? Is she going to want to present herself as white? Is she going to want to come up with her own name a la Tiger Woods? So, yeah.
there was certainly never a moment where we thought, oh, well, this would be too hard, so we wouldn't have a kid. That would be silly. So that wasn't something that we would have considered at all. But I think it was also that we knew that we would be very intentional about making sure that she never felt isolated. She never felt like there was something so unusual about her or something like that. And it's a different generation. I mean, almost all of her best friends are biracial. So it's certainly in her world, there's nothing unusual about this. She's blonde. She has curly hair. And it's also another example of how you realize how much white people in general just understand white as normal, because the only people who don't think of her as biracial or don't even pick up on it are white people. Most people who ask me if she's, they always ask me if she's mixed. It's almost always a black person who asked. But if Cord is present, then people will assume that she's mixed. But if Cord is not present, people assume that she's white.
Most of the time. I did have one kind of cute incident where I was with her at a park and a little girl, like maybe about 11, 12, clearly African-American girl, looked at my daughter and looked at me and said, "That's your daughter?" She was completely incredulous. And I was like, "Yes, yes, that is my daughter." And she said, and then went on about playing. It didn't really make me feel, you know, much one way or the other, because I guess I've always expected that, you know, having a child with our genetics could look any number of ways. So I was fully prepared for the idea that I might have a child who, when people see me with her alone, assume, wow, how can that be his child? Or a child who, when people see Leslie with her alone, would say, whoa, how can that be her child? So it didn't surprise me in any way when that child said that, especially because since it was another child, yeah, she didn't have the filter to make her not say it. I'm sure there are adults who've, you know, seen me hanging out with my daughter alone and done a double take and then thought, whoa, you know, is that his daughter? If so, she must be biracial. Or, you know, is that like his girlfriend's child who's not his? Where I'm sure that people have, you know, have a whole little thought spiral that most other adults simply would not say.
Our daughter is 3. And last year, right around the time of the election, she was 2, 2.5. And Cord and I had been talking about how we were going to speak with her about race. We were trying to figure out what she actually understood and what she didn't, what she had noticed, not wanting to give her information that she couldn't necessarily understand. So we had talked about how we were going to start talking about colors and noticing that people in her family are different colors. But we also didn't really want to use the terms white and black because she was just figuring out her colors. And it was actually a little confusing to her to think of like, she calls me pink and she calls daddy brown or chocolate. But then the election happened and everyone was we were all pretty devastated. And so she goes to a preschool. And one of her classmates just very honestly asked the teacher that now the new leader was somebody who didn't like people with dark skin. And so all of a sudden we were having to be more preemptively have this discussion with her. And we still weren't quite sure she understood or she even registered that certain people had darker skin than others. And so I posted something about that on Facebook, and that was when we got this really strong response back from all our friends talking about how much they wanted to check in with us. They wanted to make sure that we were okay. They wanted to make sure that we also had some friends whose their children's schools had swastikas on them or their children's schools had racial slurs that were written on them. So it was this real intense time of hatred. And that, honestly, we had been married almost 8 years by that point. We'd been together for almost a dozen years. And that was the first time that it no longer felt like old news, where all of a sudden it felt like, I kept thinking back to the Lovings, and I kept thinking, like, that decision was 10 years before I was even born. And to think that 50 years later, I even had an uncle who asked if we felt okay walking down the street. And I think it was just because he didn't know. He wanted to make sure we were okay. That felt really, really different.
Short breadth of time that only 50 years is. My intellectual specialty is the Middle Ages. I work on stuff that's 1,000 years old, even more commonly stuff that's 600 and 700 years old. So yeah, 50 years is nothing. And in some ways, I'm actually quite excited and proud of us as a society for how far we have come in 50 years. We've actually come quite a long way. It is much more common to have interracial couples and interracial families now. There are a lot more people who are adults who identify as bi or multiracial than there were in 1967. That said, what happened in November really hit home because it crashed down a lot of our, in some ways, defense mechanisms, the bulwarks we've put up around the circles we roll in, that we've put up around our individual families. Those forces we were always fighting against are still very much present. They just became invisible for a while. And they've become quite visible again.
And I think that was something that it became more apparent to us in hindsight how much we really had done that, where we wanted to live, where we were willing to send our kid to school. We wouldn't want to live in an all-white suburb. We wouldn't want our daughter to conceive of that as a normal place to grow up. And I think it all seemed very normal, a normal part of American life. And then when we looked back on it and thought, we probably put more effort into this than a couple who is not interracial. I guess I think about things preemptively a lot. Like, for example, our daughter has very curly hair, and I'm very familiar of a long history of negative stereotypes against curly hair, and particularly in the African-American community. So, I think if my daughter were white and just had curly hair, I don't think I would be thinking about it in the same way. And so I'm just constantly, isn't it fantastic to have curls? So I'm just constantly talking about those things. And so it's a preemptive strategy. Or, isn't it great that the whole family has different colored skin? Thinking about those things. So
there are ways in which, for us, being an interracial family does mean being very intentional about certain things, being very deliberate. And yeah, maybe it actually does take more work than it might if we were a monoracial family. But to my mind, it's every bit worth it. I'd say it makes me more aware of the often undiscussed, often unseen crossovers between particular segments of what would be thought of as white culture and what would be thought of as Black culture, and which is also regional. For instance, Leslie is from the South. And when we were first dating, it was the first Christmas season when we were dating so seriously that she did come up to Philly for part of it with me. And we were at my parents' house. And it was New Year's Eve. We went out to a party on New Year's Eve. And then we came in, and my mother had prepared black-eyed peas for luck and collard greens for money, which have to be the first things you eat in the new year, in the hopes that you will have those things in the year.
And I was absolutely delighted. My mom had passed away a few years before. I didn't keep the tradition going, but I was just so excited. And of course, Cord didn't really know any white people in New Jersey who did that.
I didn't really think
of it as a Black thing. I thought of it as a Southern thing. But of course, Black and Southern are often the same. And that kind of thing makes you realize just how weird it is that white and Black Southerners don't talk to each other more, because they're doing a lot of the same kind of cultural things, like with food.
I believe Leslie's exact words when she saw them on the stove were, you do this too? And I was like, well, of course, but you said too. You do it too?
We'd like to thank Cord and Leslie for sharing their story with us.
You can find The Loving Project on iTunes or anywhere else podcasts are distributed. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review.
You can also find out more about the podcast at our website, lovingproject.com, where you'll also find pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show and links to follow us on social media. I'm Brad Linder.
And I'm Farrah Parks. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project. In the next episode of The Loving Project, we hear from Steve and Christine.
Steve is white and Christine is black. They met in Philadelphia in the 1960s, when things were difficult for interracial couples, even in a state where it would have been legal for them to marry at the time.
During the civil rights era, police would stop you and
we got stopped a lot of times.
Yeah, we did get stopped a lot. So much so that, I mean, if you're out late at night, you know, you're riding down the street, your lights are working, you know, there's no reason to stop you, but you get stopped and harassed.
In fact, we moved to New York to eventually get out of that. That's why we moved to New York. We got tired of getting stopped.
Steve and Christine's story, coming up next time on The Loving Project.